Hello.
Bobby.
Michael.
Can you hear me okay?
Michael Lofton.
Yes, sir.
Miguel.
The guy, that guy from the past.
That guy that flew us around in
you're,
the past.
You're way past. Now we can say way
cool.
past.
Cool, how you doing? Yeah,
good.
Don't go that far, okay?
Yeah, like I was looking at the date, right around 77.
Wow, I was so young.
And you had a lot of hair then.
So much fun, too, they told me.
Yeah,
I did have a lot of hair, and, you know, it's still there if I ever wanted to grow it back. It may be a different color, but...
Oh. That's
mostly still there. I've been blessed with a lot of hair. There's nothing inside the brain left, but a lot of hair.
Well, this is why I figured I wanted to get this call down before our dementia goes much further, you know.
You better hurry. I'm meeting with some guy next month that's writing. We're going to start writing a book. Before I forget everything, too. And I just don't have the patience to do it myself, so I found this ghostwriter that's going to work with me. And he's a really huge fan, and he's a pretty good writer. So, you know, he'll give a good perspective of it.
Well, good. Yeah. I'm not sure the angle. You might want to expound upon it just a little bit more about the angle you're going to use for your book. Mine is primarily... coming from the production side, I guess you would say, you know, kind of the it's the inside, but it's not, you know, it's not tabloidish like you would find with Inquirer magazine or something like that. It's more insider, you know, backstage guys. What do those guys do? You know,
they
bust their ass, but what really goes on, you know, and what kind of shenanigans do they get into, or what kind of interesting little endeavors take place, to even totally aside from the artist, even though you're kind of related to the artist?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where mine's coming from, you know, a little even more inside, you know, being so close to the boss.
Mm-hmm.
But not tabloidish, but stuff that you wouldn't hear, you know, otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
You know, got to be careful how far I go.
Yeah. Exactly. And I, for the most part, I'm not really naming a lot of names. Well, the fact that I flew the star, you know, the star name, but
right.
A lot of that stuff. You can dance around storytelling and not really divulge the exact individual. Now, sometimes the dead ones might be okay to talk about.
Great. Well, that's about everybody in the book. Oh, God. Anyway, ask away here.
Yeah,
what
so, you know, when I was reading, I was I kind of glanced through the book that you're mentioning quite a bit, A Good Life All the Way.
Brian White?
Yeah, I think, Brian White was the co-writer on that.
Ryan.
And
right. Then there's another book I wrote the foreword to. It's by Scott Atwell. It's like 50 backstories of Jimmy's songs. He's done a lot of research on them, and it's a very interesting book. So that's out there. He's only selling it on Amazon. He doesn't have a publisher, so you got to look for it in specialty stores and stuff. But just did that one too, and so There's a lot of good, great stories out there that people, I think, would like to hear that never would hear if someone didn't write them.
Well, it mentioned that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but just before you took off with Buffett, and it'd be interesting to hear that story again, even though you've probably been asked 1,000 times, but you were with the Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder Review. Was that true?
I was just for a few months at the tail end of the second leg he did, I believe.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was, that was my first tour I ever did.
Oh, okay. So, and you came driving a cab or something like that?
Driving a cab, and then I actually was working for the University of Florida.
Okay.
As their technical director. And this is after I got, you know, I was working at the Great Southern Music Hall in Gainesville, and then I got a gig with the University of Florida. I met Jimmy at the Great Southern Music Hall the first time ever, and he was so fucked up, he probably doesn't remember me. But Gainesville, Florida was the technical director. We did like 50 shows a year. Did Jimmy one outdoor concert, and he apparently took my phone number because later on he did call me. But while I was at the University of Florida, we had this thing called Gator Growl, where they have, it's for the homecoming, and they have this huge show outdoors at the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And like 40,000 people, and we had Bob Dylan and the Rolling Thunder Review. And we did all the, you know, did the stage setup. I think we may have even done the sound and lights. But anyway, so at the end of the show, when we were striking, their production manager, Michael Ahern, who you may have heard of, very famous production manager, did everybody's tours. He died a number of years ago, unfortunately. But anyway, he came up to me and said, "You got a great crew here. Would you like to come on tour with us?" And, you know, I was in college, trying to graduate, but yet didn't want to graduate because of the Vietnam War. So I said, you know, "I really appreciate the offer, but I can't leave college." You know, he said he'd have to leave with us immediately. So I said, "Yeah, I really appreciate it, but thank you." And I walked away. And then I walked like four steps away and I went, "You idiot, you know, you're never going to get an offer like this again. Just take it." So turned around, I said, "I'll take the gig. When do you need me to be? Where do you need me to be?" He says, "I need you to be in Tallahassee tomorrow." So that was it. I went on tour for them. It was like, we never knew where we were going a week before. It was like, seemed like they booked it while we were out there. So I didn't know how long it was going to be. It lasted about 2 months, I think.
Now,
so,
what was your title on that? Was that road manager? Or
oh,
something?
It was like, I don't even think I had a title. I was like the bottom of the totem pole for roadies. I did, you know, whatever little stuff needed to be done. Bob painted these pictures on these 4x8 pieces of plywood, and that was my job, was to hang those up in whatever venue we played at. You know, not rigged or anything, just anywhere I could do it. So, you know, sometimes it would be in seats behind the stage or whatever. That's what I did. So, you know, just being out there was a dream for me.
Yeah.
So I don't remember much about it. I didn't take much pictures like an idiot. Didn't save any memorabilia except what's left in my brain.
Right.
I know that I remember one time I was sitting backstage, and when they hired me, they said, you know, "Just mind your own business. Don't talk to Bob. You know, just be cool." I said, I wouldn't even know what to say to the man. So sitting backstage one time, and he comes up to me and goes, "Hey, how you doing?" And like sits down next to me. I go, "Oh, fine, Mr. Dillon. How are you?" "Just fine, you know." And then there was like silence, and he gets up and goes, "Okay, see you later." So so that was it. That was the only time I ever interacted with him.
Uh-huh.
So at the end of the 2 months, you know, great. Here you are. You just quit school, you dummy. Now what are you going to do? The band that some of the musicians that backed him up went and formed a band, and I went on tour with them for like 2 months. They were called the Alpha Band. T-Bone Burnett, Stephen Souls, David Mansfield, really good musicians. I mean, you've probably heard of T-Bone Burnett.
He's mm-hmm.
really famous musician. So we did that for a while. I was their guitar roadie at first, and then once I started stringing the guitars backwards, they fired me and turned me over to truck driver and drum roadie, and that was a trip. We did some backup shit for Doobie Brothers, and then I was out of work again. Moved back home in with my mother, Fort Lauderdale. I was driving a taxi cab at that point in Fort Lauderdale when we got the call from Mr. Buffett.
Oh, so that was like in the mid-70s, right? 76?
Yeah, early 70s, 79, 70, yeah. 72, maybe, 73.
And then you guys were touring before I got involved with the Fairchild, the cheeseburger plane. Well, I guess we call it the second cheeseburger plane, the big cheeseburger plane.
Right. What was the first cheeseburger
plane? You called it the King. I think the King Air or something was like your first.
Oh, the King Air. Okay.
What wasn't that? Weird pilot that smoked all the time or something like that?
No, George. So I thought George was a Queen Air. I was thinking about that the other day. Was it a King Air that George?
Well, the King Air would have been a turbine engine. The Queen Air would have been naturally aspirated or piston engine.
But twin engine, right?
Yeah, they're both twin engines, yeah.
And you didn't find George for us. We found them some other way, I believe.
Right. No, George was just before we did our, you know, I was with you guys for 12 years, or at least, you know, consulting
right.
with you. But I think he was just before you guys moved into the larger plane, the Fairchild, the F-27.
But were you still our consultant for finding the Queen Air, the King Air, whatever it was?
You mean during that time?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, any of your ancillary planes, I would help you secure. In fact, we did In fact, we did the West Coast, and this is part of a question I have for you. I might as well jump into it. The volcano.
That was the King Air, right?
Yeah, it was
right,
the F-90 King Air.
And the funny thing about George is, before you skip over him,
yeah,
was he was always smoking a cigarette. I mean, like, from the time you took off to the time the wheels touched the ground, cigarette in his mouth. And the way you can tell how long the flight was by the pile of ashes on his lap. So that's all I remember about George. Excellent, excellent pilot.
Uh-huh.
But that those pile of ashes on his lap was...
And a damn
George.
Good chain smoker.
A damn good chain smoker. Damn good. That's, I mean, he smoked so much our pot smoking couldn't overpower his cigarette smoking.
Yeah,
and you can empathize with that.
Oh yeah. All right. So after George flew you for a while, I forget how the tie was. I remember walking into Howard and Irving's office. Actually, I walked in. Off the street, basically, you know, because I was living in Southern California at the time, and I was in the aviation business. And I said, you know, I want to see if I can get myself into the entertainment business here a little bit. I had flown entertainers for a subcontractor before that, the Commodores. Flew the Commodores before, you know, Lionel Richie took off and did his solo thing. In fact, I was spent time in Lionel's house, and he actually sang the song Lady before he ever released it to us in his living room. And then Elvis Presley was taxiing out to pick up Elvis Presley on the day he killed himself. We're on our way to take off, and the towers said, your administration office requests you taxi back. So we taxi back.
God.
We get off the plane. They're going, no more Elvis. So.
Oh, my God.
It was just kind of a weird timing thing on that. But after that little stint working for other people flying larger aircraft and seeing how the operation worked, I ended up finding myself a backer to go out and buy this Fairchild. And then I said, I got to get somebody to fly in it. And I remember walking in Howard's office downtown, Frontline.
Right.
And I... had fucking Polaroid pictures of the F-27, and I just talked. I didn't have a brochure. I didn't have shit. You know, but I gave him a good rap because Howard's, you know, he's talking to me a little about it. He's going, "Well, you really want to get into flying in the entertainment business on your own?" And I go, "Yeah, I think I can do a good job at it." And he goes, he screams across the room, "Hey, Irving, come here. I want you to meet somebody." You know, so he walks in. He shows him the Polaroids. And he looks over at Howard. He's going, "Okay, well, your call, buddy." And then somehow they got you on the phone or something, like, "Hey, we got a plane for you for the 77. I forget what it was called. I think it's 77. I'll have to look back at my notes, but I'm pretty sure it's, I have most of the contracts still. So, but I do remember the story behind the plane, and I wanted to get your thought about it. I want to come back to the volcano in a second here, since I've already went off in this other branch. And the fact that we flew the plane out to pick you up, and I believe it was Des Moines or Tri-City, Moline, Illinois, or something like that. And I remember you walked out to the plane with Jimmy, and Weir had fucking ties on or something. And the first thing Jimmy says, "Take the ties off." and then he goes, then you went to Jimmy. You go, "Jimmy, look at the tail. The tail, it's got JB. It's got your initials on it." He's going, "Well, that's kind of cool." You know, but did I ever tell you the story behind how the JB initials got on the plane?
Yes, I read it somewhere. I think you sent me a story about it.
Yeah.
Maybe in Facebook, maybe?
Right, yeah. Okay. It used to be, or I have it a little bit on my blog just to kind of start the teaser for the book to eventually build up some momentum. But it was originally owned by Hubbard Broadcasting Company in St. Paul, Minnesota. And that's where we bought the plane from. So it had HB on the side. And when we flew the plane back to California, and it's about a few weeks before we're ready to blast off to pick you up, I'm sitting there looking at the HB going, "Fuck, I guess I got to paint this over." And a guy walks behind me with a spray can shaking it. And it just got me thinking, no, wait a minute. I'll just take the side of the H off and turn it into a J, and it'll be JB now. So that's how the JB cheeseburger airplane became. So the volcano.
Go ahead.
The volcano thing came up because I remember you called it the King Kong tour, the acoustic tour on the West Coast.
The King Kong Trio.
Yeah, the King Kong Trio. And I kind of thought that emerged from us flying. Remember, we flew over the volcano. It was only like a month after it blew its top.
Mm-hmm.
Mount St. Helens. We got a clearance to fly over, and I put Jimmy in the right front seat. And when I saw the King Kong Trio, I was thinking, I wonder if it was there any relationship with the volcano, you know, King Kong on the volcano, but maybe not.
No. Yeah. That would have made a good story, but no. I don't know why King Kong. That's an excellent question, but I don't think it was named that before we went around the volcano. If I remember, the volcano was a spur of the moment thing, wasn't it?
You absolutely.
Wait.
We had no idea on takeoff, and then all of a sudden we're looking over there going, well, shit. And I think we were on Air Central Traffic Control, and we heard some other aircraft had waivers to go over and fly around it, and we're thinking, what about us? And they gave us a transponder code, and it basically allowed us to just go around that rim and take a look inside, you know, the bubbling fusion going on.
Jimmy was flying, which was, you know, made everybody, at that point, he really wasn't licensed that long, if he even was licensed.
Yeah, I remember you guys would freak out and every time Jimmy goes sit up in the seat.
Yeah, we weren't really feeling very good about that. And then, you know, he was doing a serious bank going around it. So, yeah, I think there was drinking going on in the back. Sam Clayton was probably burning one at that point.
So the volcano, the question is, well, getting back to your mention in the book, where the original volcano blew for the writing of the song came. We just happened, the synchronicity hit it at the time that Mount St. Helens had blown, just a few weeks before we started that tour, right, and were able to make that happen. So tell me about the real volcano.
So the Montserrat volcano?
Yeah, is that the one?
You know, when we were down there, it was mostly just smoking. The most of the stories from down there were about the band smoking and all the craziness that went on behind the scenes of making that record. You know, there was no, you know, I don't mean to be racist, but it wasn't a tourist island. You know, Montserrat was just a few hundred locals that lived there, and no white women really, or tourists. So there was nothing to do at night. So a lot of rum was drank. They had a lot of local rum. So, you know, poor Deborah McCall was really the only female down there. And just some of the crazy shit stories that happened while we were down there, with crazy Barry Chance and, you know, fingers drunk all the time. Uh-huh. You know, there was an open bar down there. The recording studio was fabulous. The mountain was right. The volcano was right. The studio was almost at the foot of the volcano. So you can take a day trip and go up to the mountain, where you see a few pictures of Keith Sykes and sitting by one of the Soufriere's vents and stuff. So, that's a book in itself. If you ever get a chance to watch the documentary about the recording studio down there, it's on Netflix or anything, Beneath the Volcano or something like that. Huh. It's about George Martin and the studio. And they met, Jimmy's in it, and then we were the second one down there. So, it was just a logistical nightmare getting to. It's not like there were direct flights down there.
Right.
So, I don't know. I may even have called you for help. I think we just chartered some planes from St. Thomas, flew commercially down there, and then chartered from St. Thomas. But Jimmy had people coming and going all the time. So, and, you know, it's not like you could go run down to the store, to Ace Hardware or the liquor store, and pick up something. It was quite a logistical nightmare running the whole show. But, you know, we pulled it off, and I think it's one of his best albums, actually.
Uh-huh. Cool. Now, you know, as a road manager, I basically just used to call you the babysitter of the adults that...
is it just a high-paid babysitter?
Of the chaos of the... it's like herding cats, I guess you would say. Juggling cats is even worse. But, how would you describe what you were actually... Because you had so many areas that you were covering. Not just the band, but you had, with me with the aircraft, you had buses and trucks and stage people. I just found it fascinating how you can manage all that at once.
Well, back then, too, I mean, if you go on Jimmy's tour now, there's about, I don't know, I'm probably underestimating. There's probably at least 12 people that are doing what I did by myself. And then we added Mike Mooney as my assistant, and then Brent came along for the, you know, for doing the luggage and stuff once we got the airplane. But there's a lot more involved than just herding the cattle around. There was a involved. I had to do the settlements at night. That was probably the most fun part of my day, you know, watching the accountants, I mean, the promoters trying to rip us off and me getting back at them and getting more money.
Wow.
I enjoyed that the most, you know, watching them sit at the table and sweat while, you know, I'm asking for every friggin' receipt in the world that they are giving me, you know, charges for. But, yeah, there was, you know, we back then, I would, one for one tour, I can't remember which one it was, but I went up to Ross Ritto. You remember Ross?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So he was a stage mix guy.
Yeah.
He ran the sound.
He owned the sound company. And back in the early days, we went up to he had a sailboat out in Rochester on St. Lawrence or something. And we planned the whole tour from his sailboat. We had a landline phone there. And, you know, trucking was involved back then. And we had to do all the trucking, the sound and light companies. We had to hire all the band and crew. We did all their hotel bookings back then. In the beginning, I used a travel agent for the hotel bookings. But, you know, every time the travel agent would fuck up, I would get yelled up by Jimmy. He wouldn't yell at the travel agent. So after a while, we created Bob's Travel, and I just did all the bookings myself. And
I remember that, Bob's Travel on the tour sheets. Yep.
Itinerary. And, yeah, you know, our motto was we fuck up, we stay up, open 24 hours.
Yeah, and you also dealt with per diem. I mean, what was it like getting, like, the cats, hurting the cats to get them up to catch the plane, or just the timing to get them over to sound check in general? I mean,
there was no GPS back then. A lot of times we had to use rental cars. So we actually had maps that we had to use, and constantly getting lost. You know, once you dropped us off from the airport, and a lot of these towns didn't have limos back then, we had to get rental cars. So we would be getting lost all the time. It got to the point where, you know, we get to an intersection and Jimmy would go, which way? And I go left. And he'd go, okay, turn right. And 90% of the time, you know, I was wrong and he was right. So, but that's another story. But, everything. Back then, everything was involved. Now, you know, the road manager, Charlie Fernandez, you probably know Charlie.
Is he still the road manager for Jimmy to this day?
He is still the road manager, but he doesn't. They have a tour accountant, at least one or two. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do anything. He just travels along with them. Everything else is done by everybody else. It's like people that are in charge of the dressing rooms. You know, they have so many people. It's amazing.
Wow. I mean, you still. Go ahead.
No, back then I did everything pretty much. You know, I didn't do any of the production. We got everybody out there.
Right.
You know, Ross and the sound guy and Ricky Holcomb, they did all that. I didn't mess with any of that.
Mm-hmm. But you had to deal with setting up, you know, girlfriends, friends, wives, groupies, tickets every damn day.
All that. And, you know, we didn't have computers either. We had to use pieces of paper. And, you know, just running between the box office and the dressing room. It's crazy.
And when they
came out with fax machines, we thought it was like the white bread, you know, the most amazing thing in the world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I could imagine you in the room just... phone call after phone call. What is this one? Okay, you know, now I got to get, you know, make sure that Perry gets picked up, or remind him to get moving at this time. And then the next phone call is somebody's trying to get his wife included on the, you know, backstage pass and all that shit. Because you had to break it up. The whole backstage thing is kind of intriguing to a lot of people that don't know what's going on back there, Now, it's really kind of a separated area, if you will, in a couple different ways. How would you describe that?
Different levels.
Yeah.
Of of security. You know, you've got your people that the relatives, the wives and family,
mm-hmm.
The non-revs. you know, they get the most priority. Everything but the dressing rooms, and then even the wives. Some of the wives get the dressing. You know, it's like a with Jimmy was walking a fine line because he really enjoyed his privacy. Was not big on wives when I was working with him, and probably still not,
uh-huh.
and family. So you really didn't want to insult anybody, but you know, you couldn't yet. You know, you can't go in there, you know. So. You know, and then you've got the groupies who would get access, but not the dressing rooms. We would have our own dressing room, just called the Club Oreo. You probably remember the Club Oreo.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, that was usually in the back of the airplane. Also, the Club Oreo.
Right. Yeah.
Even fingers put up aluminum foil on the window just to give it a little. Genesis Block. So, you know, and then during, you know, it was crazy during the, back then, I worked with Jimmy during the days when he was, his divorce or separation days.
Uh-huh.
But he was married to Jane for a few years too, but mostly when he was divorced, and we're not going to name any dates, but,
sure.
You know, it'd be like during the show and I'd be standing over by the monitor board. Just minding my own business right before going to do my job at the box office to pick up the money. Mm-hmm. And like Jimmy would look over to me and like signal for me to come out on stage. And I go, really? You want me to come on stage? Like in hand signals. He goes, yeah, come on, come over here. Okay. So I go out there and he'd whisper in my ear, you see that girl in the third row, the blonde? I go, yeah. Go out and give her a pass, come backstage after the show. I said, that's what you asked me to come out here for? Really? He goes, yeah, go do it. I said, okay. So, you know, that would happen to during the night. So everyone, all these girls would be backstage. Or if during the early days when we were flying, we wouldn't fly out of the city as we fly the next day. So we'd have the luxury of having a hotel overnight, which we didn't have when we were busing. We'd leave right after the show. So we'd have the Club Oreo that we would rent, you know, a suite for every night, because I was tired of my room being the Club Oreo.
Uh-huh.
I got smart, you know, so we'd rent an extra room. Nobody would have to have the party in their room. So, of course, all these beautiful girls would come after the show to the Club Oreo that I had invited, and the band would be in the bathroom snorting cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So, and like everybody's out there, even if the girls are going, well, when's Jimmy coming? Well, I don't know, honey. So it's like it was just like such a waste. Unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, I was single back then, so somebody had to, you know, entertain these women.
Uh-huh.
And it was a dirty, stinking, rotten job, and I had to do it. So I'm not complaining, mind you, and
yeah.
None of them turned out to be my wife, thank God. So,
so
that's what happened.
Yeah, speaking of ladies, we had a couple of, well, one episode for sure, but I think it was a couple episodes. I can remember quite a few episodes with all the different entertainers I flew, but with stewardesses.
Oh, God. Well, that didn't work out too well with us, as you remember.
Well, most
of our stewardesses, they were chased after by Fingers Taylor. You know, they liked the poor girls. Everybody wanted to date them, I guess. Or do other stuff with them. So they weren't able to do their duties. And finally, Jimmy just said, just fire them. I can't have this shit going on. There's too much drama as it is.
I remember that. And I remember you telling, I think it was in Mountain Air, if I get it right, somewhere in California. It was a small venue. It was a venue that's kind of in one of those Sonoma County areas out there.
Right.
And I remember you coming up to me and said, Jimmy wants, I forget her name now, but he wants her fired.
Julia?
Yeah. Was that it?
Julia. Wow, I'm impressed.
And I'm thinking, okay, how am I going to break this to her? I know she's going to bawl her eyes out, you know, but.
I know. She didn't think she did anything wrong. Well, you know, apparently she did, but I felt real sorry for her. You know, and after that, we just didn't have any other flight attendants. You guys would just tell us what to do if there was a problem. And Brent and I would do our our little announcements at the beginning of each flight.
And you brought up
putting the sneaker over his face as a face mask. Oh, and then the time I ran up to tell you the plane was on fire or something.
Hit
by lightning.
Oh yeah, no, that was hit by that. That's a story in my book for sure. It comes from the production side of.
Oh,
you know,
the ball of lightning rolling down the aisle.
Oh yeah, I remember a couple times you running up to the up front. You said,
right. Great. Be calm, Bob.
Yeah. One time it was, I just flashed on this right now, as a matter of fact, that we're lowering the Fairchild F-27 did not have speed brakes. What it had for speed brakes is you can lower the landing gear.
Uh-huh, right.
And we were at altitude and we lowered the landing gear and you came running up going, hey, dude, do you know the landing gear came down? And I don't know if you remember Bill, it was Bill Merrick, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And Bill says, weird. Bobby, it's our speed brakes. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, now I remember that one. And then, I think that was, didn't we have a four-engine plane, really, like slow bus?
That's when I was doing more after I flew you personally, you know, trading off with co-captains in the F-27.
Right.
Then I was your consultant and provided, you know, the aircraft and did the flight following the same way you would normally have done it, but along with the new, you know, full crew and different aircraft after that. And you speak of the Viscount.
The Viscount. I think that's where the St. Elmo's fire rolled down the aisle or something.
I forget exactly how that story goes. You might want to expand on that one a little more.
Well, it was during a thunderstorm, and we couldn't really go out over the storms in that plane.
No,
we basically
those planes were limited to, like the Fairchild, about 28,000 feet. You needed to be up around 35 to 37 to get over this.
Right. Well, we had no choice. We went through this sucker. We were all buckled in, and he told us to hold on. It's going to get a little bumpy here. And I think we got struck by lightning or whatever created the effect. I was sitting in the back. There was a little lounge in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Huge plane. It was
Yeah,
and this ball of electricity or static electricity, bigger than a basketball, like pretty big, just rolled through the cockpit, down the center aisle, and out the tail. And everybody looked at each other and go, "What the fuck was that?" And of course, I did one of my famous run to the cockpit, and. I said, I think we just got hit by lightning. He goes, it's okay. Everything's okay. We didn't lose any of our equipment or anything. Just go back and sit down. We'll talk about it later or whatever, something like that.
Right.
So I went back and everyone's looking at me like, for now, I said, I don't know what the fuck happened, you know? So just sit down and I don't drink, but I started drinking like whiskey straight from the bottle. It's like, holy crap.
Wow.
Nobody knew what there was. When he landed, they explained that it doesn't happen a lot, but it it's been known to happen.
And you just happened to hit one of those occasions that you got to see it in action.
We did, and you know, I think when we landed, you know, everyone got out of a plane, kissed the ground, and then got in and got into. This is, you know, between me and you, we're out of cocaine, so everybody was really desperate. They wanted to go get fucked up. That we just survived the near death experience. So
right, yeah,
everyone knew that. We were landing in Peachtree, Charlie Brown Airport, maybe.
Okay.
If I remember, it was Atlanta. May have been the same flight. Would we have landed the Viscount into Charlie Brown?
I believe so, yeah.
Anyway, we were staying at the Omnitown. It was late at night, like 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and everyone knew I was getting a package of Flow in the mail, FedEx. So I went to the front desk. Usually nobody is there to watch me check in, but everyone's like hanging around me like a bunch of vultures. So I check everybody in, and they go, oh, by the way, do you have a package for Lieberman? They go, yes, there's FedEx package. So they give it to me, and like their fingers started attacking me, trying to grab the package. So I ran away, and I'm running away, and he tackles me, and the package falls out and opens up on the floor. And like there's a little bit of it fell out in the floor, and fingers is like snorting. This is in the middle of the Omni Hotel in Atlanta.
Oh, God.
I go, you've got to be fucking kidding me. This is not happening. So anyway, I think everyone calmed down. I said, just go back to your rooms. I'll tell you when we get it divided up or something.
Really?
So anyway, yes. That was like, that's going to be in my book, or about that fireball going down the aisle.
Huh.
A lot of good airplane stories come to mind, you know, when I start talking about them.
What kind of if any of the airplane stories pop up, please let me know.
Not as funny as you have to be there for most of them, you know.
The one I remember that you talk about, the you said lightning ball, but or fire in the engine. It happened to be our last trip that I personally flew you with Bill Merrick, and we were on our way to Florida. I forget where in Florida. I'd have to refer to my notes again, but we're coming out of. Somewhere in the south interior, and we could just see major thunderstorms up ahead of us. But that wasn't the issue. The issue was we've got sparks coming out of the right engine as we're cruising at altitude. And we knew it exactly at the first moment when the autopilot clicked off, and we started to lose, you know, there's two electricity buses in that aircraft for redundancy, for safety. So if you lose one bus, you still have a backup bus. But we noticed that one of the buses kicked off, an electric bus, and the autopilot kicked off. And, you know, Bill and I look at each other going, well, that's interesting. So we reset the autopilot, and it was motoring along just fine. Then all of a sudden, there's a big flash out of my right, because I was sitting right seat, co-pilot seat, and just major flash going on. And that's about the time you ran up to the cockpit going, hey, dude, you know, the right engine's on fire or something like that.
I don't remember that.
It was the very last flight, and we had, as I recall, Jimmy let a few of the people from the Little River Band fly on this flight.
Of course.
So, so anyway, basically, to make a long story as short as possible, is it was a lot of commotion in the cockpit, but Bill and I had worked with each other so much up to that point in time that everything, we weren't excited. We were just thinking, well, let's figure out what the hell's going on here. I thought it was a turbine rub, which is very expensive, just thinking of that. But After looking at it a few times, and we Bill's going, "What's your call?" Because Bill can't see the right engine. I'm just seeing sparks coming out of the fucking front of this engine, and they're flying. And I'm going back and forth, and we're double checking the gauges, the motors, all the temperatures in the motors look great. Everything looks stable, except this thing's bursting out like a fucking Boston Pops on July 4th. And the fact that the electricity's kind of still quark, being a little wonky and shit. And so we're actually seriously talking about shutting the motor down, which, as you know, the airplane's still going to fly okay with one engine. We could have gone somewhere and land.
Right.
But
right.
It was just one of those, oh, God, it's a fucking hassle. But we got to deal with it. So
right.
I'm looking at this. He's going, "What's your call, Lofton? What are we going to do? What's the procedure?" And I go, "Well, stand by. I'm going to take one more good look." And I honed in right on the engine nacelle to where the best I could. And I noticed the spark coming from the outer little portion of the nacelle, which is your anti-ice, which is high electricity to keep the ice from building, from getting inside the engine. Apparently the wire, something we picked up on the runway on departure, what's called a FOD, foreign object damage, a rock or something, nicked that little wire enough that it created a gap in the wire, and it, at an altitude where the pressure was less, started sparking like a bitch.
Right.
And it was fucking with the electricity. So I just reached up and took the number two anti-ice toggle, and I announced it to Bill. I'm shutting off number two anti-ice. Reached up, shut it off. Sparks died just like that. And bus two came back up. Everything stabilized, and Bill and I look at each other going, "It's got to happen in the fucking last fight, doesn't it?" And,
oh my God!
But this is where this is the weird part that we never discussed it in depth. It was kind of talked about when we got on the ground, and when Jimmy came around, I showed him what happened. He's going, "Well, I guess the flight gods were looking after us." Well, I think it was more than that, because Bill Merrick, after you guys split, pulled out the map. He's going, "Do you know where this happened?" I go, "Yeah, I know it happened halfway between our fucking flight." And he's going, "Look where it happened." And he showed me.
Oh,
it was Gaithersburg or wherever, where the Leonard Skinner crashed. And we're thinking,
spooky.
It had to be a synchronicity. They're going, "Hey, dudes, we're here. We're just going to rattle your chain a little bit. We won't kill you. We'll just rattle your chain."
Creepy. Very creepy.
And, to this day, I believe that that's a possibility. And, synchronicities, I'm sure you've run into a bunch of them on the road.
Yeah, that sounds very likely.
Interesting little tidbit like that.
It did.
Did Hunter Thompson ever come up in your conversations?
You know, Hunter would pop in and out at concerts, and when I would be in Aspen, he'd show up. But Hunter was too serious for me. I couldn't hang with him too long. He was just like very... God, he's heavy. He was very heavy. How to explain?
Yeah.
He drank a lot and did a lot of drugs, and I wasn't big on hanging with people for too long of time.
Right.
Very introvert when I was on the road, believe it or not. You never saw me out partying with the band afterwards.
Well, you would regulate yourself. You would because you had so much. You're juggling so many things too. You had to get back.
I had to wake up in the morning, so somebody had to be the responsible adult on the road. So,
exactly.
But maybe that's why I'm still alive to these days. So didn't do half as much as the shit they ingested.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you brought up a good point there which I bring in my book, that's probably not relevant to your book at all, but for pilots, we always had our own little, I had a I guess you'd call it, criterion that we do not party the same night that with the band if we're going to fly them the next day.
Good rule. Well, 24 hours bottle of throttle and whatever. Yeah,
well, it's actually less than that. It's 8 hours bottle of throttle. But have you ever flown with a hangover? It sucks.
That's not fun, no.
It's just horrible.
No, it's bad enough fucking with a hangover.
Oh, it's just horrible.
God, no.
Yeah, so we would make sure, and this was kind of an issue with this early on with the stewardesses, bringing them back up again, because they would always go, oh, no, we could, you know, we want to go and party, and so we would be pretty hardcore going, no, you better not go out and party with the band if you're going to fly them the next day. If we find out, you got a one-way ticket going home. And
with our band, our brand was very horny. They wanted to, everybody wanted to fuck the poor stewardess.
Right.
So, and you know, that, and probably the boss did too, so that didn't go over well. It was very awkward, and, you know, I felt sorry for the poor girl.
Well, at that time, it was kind of an experiment, I guess, because we didn't know running the flight in itself.
Right.
And so we figured, well, if we get a competent girl or two, you know, we can at least be sure that, you know, once they know the protocol that you, like you said, later took care of yourself, emergency doors, emergency exits, seatbelts on departure, landings, you know, your basic shit. The only other thing involved there was fetching a drink or getting finger sandwiches or something. That was about
it. Exactly.
And what do you need an extra body on board to do that for? And so it subsequently turned out that you just said, just get us fucking pizzas and finger food on the way to the airplane, and we'll fetch it ourselves, you know?
Yeah. We had to try it. We tried it, and it didn't work out.
Yeah, yeah. There was one time, I don't know if you remember, in departure, speaking of emergency exit or actually exit door, we had started a departure. We were going to be taking off. I forget where it was. And we shut her down, and we taxied back. And again, you came up going, what's going on? We said, well, we got a door alert ajar. The back door light came ajar. And apparently, I don't know if it was us or because you guys also we knew how to work the door exactly right and everything. But this it was just one of those times that we didn't quite get the door locked down. And lucky for us, we got a door ajar light before we got in the air. Because so we ended up. And this comes up, and this is going to be talked about in my book, because here again, it's dealing with aviation people and people that like music, and they're interested in, you know, big names. Okay. So the idea of what killed Ricky Nelson, what killed Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, it was overzealous pilots that thought that they could get away with, you know, we can't tell them we got to land before the destination. They're going to think we don't know what we're doing here. As opposed to, no, safety, you got a problem? Yeah, we're going to end up taxiing back and finding out what the problem is. We're not going to take off. I'm sorry you're going to be late for sound check, but, you know, that's the way it is, kind of thing.
Didn't one of them run out of gas, the Lynyrd Skynyrd one?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Ricky Nelson's, the heater on board caught fire?
Yep. And I have stories on both those Bobbies. I don't know if I told you real quick. I got a phone call from Ricky Nelson's tour manager, road manager. 2 months before they hit the road, he was wanted me to put him in a DC-3, and I said, I don't do old piston engines anymore. I'll get you a good deal on a G1 or F-27 or, you know, something with turbine engines. Going, oh, I don't want to spend that extra 20%. Forget it. I want you to put me in a DC-3. And I go, I can't do it. And I got a call 2 months later, and And my friend, my poker buddy friend, said, what do you think about that crash tonight? It was New Year's Eve.
Wow.
And I said, what crash? He's going, I thought you just spoke to the road manager. You're going to put him in a plane. And I go, well, what road manager? Because by that time, I'm talking to different road managers. And he goes, Ricky Nelson just crashed. I go, fuck. Are you kidding me? And don't tell me it was a DC-3. And he's going, yeah, I think it was a DC-3.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Save some money there.
It was kind of
anyway.
Yeah, and then Lynyrd Skynyrd, I ended up flying the tour, the stage guys that got off the Lynyrd Skynyrd airplane 2 days before it crashed. They were the stage guys for Nazareth.
Uh-huh. Fuck.
Kind of interesting.
Bad shit.
Interesting story.
Interesting, yeah.
Now, when you got done with Jimmy, were you, you moved on to... You did like a wrestling thing or something like that?
So right after I left Jimmy, I worked for a year and a half at the new Lakewood Amphitheater in Atlanta as their assistant general manager. And then through politics, a lot of politics involved in those amphitheaters back then, the general manager got laid off. They brought in a new one, and he cleared house and fired everybody. So I went back on the road with I did the American Gladiators tour.
Oh.
The live tour with David Bischoff.
Now, how did that differ in general flying rock stuff, rock and roll?
It was... It was the same and yet a little different. You know, they were still acting like rock stars, even though their only talent was their muscles. Near the end of the tour, they were getting like too much like rock stars. Going, well, we're not going out because the catering wasn't. There wasn't enough gluten-free stuff in the catering tray. So guys, you know, you better be careful because you're just going to be replaced with some new gladiators. They're just going to come along, and you can't be pulling this shit off. One time they refused to go on because the food wasn't right, so they stalled the show for an hour. And I said, man, you guys, really, I'm warning you, you can't be doing this shit. So they just opened up a new can of American Gladiators and fired everybody and brought some new ones out. That was that. That was a weird ass tour. Did you ever watch the show?
The which show?
The American Gladiators on TV.
Yeah, I think I probably glanced at it a couple times.
So we were all on one tour bus, like eight gladiators, and my bunk was underneath the gladiator. His name was Tower. The guy was like 6'8" or something. It was his name for a reason. So, and I was just totally convinced that we were going to hit a bump and the bunk was going to collapse and crush me one night. So, I never slept the whole trip. And plus the fact that they were all on steroids, and I didn't know this at the time, but when you take steroids, you fart terribly.
Oh,
so it's like the bus smelled like the worst. So. The only thing that kept me alive during that tour was Mike Adamley. Remember the announcer, the TV sports announcer?
Yeah.
He still
yeah.
is Mike Adams. Really cool guy. We would stay up and talk in the front of the bus away from the steroid farts. that was just a total trip, that tour. And then I did some tour with the Damn Yankees, Ted Nugent band, and then... did that for a few months, and then
you were a road manager for Ted?
Well, it was the Damn Yankees band with Ted and Tommy Shaw and Jack Blades from Night Rangers. So really good band. We did a tour with Bad Company on a bus, and did that for a while. And then I did a Faith No More tour for a year, which was really different for me because I've, you know, never worked a headbanging band before. So we did some dates with Metallica and Guns N' Roses and then did our own tour over in Europe, which was really a cool experience for me because I'd never toured Europe, you know, with Jimmy. He's not very big over there. So.
Oh, he's not? Huh.
No, well, he is now. He's getting he's big everywhere, but he's not like he is in the States. You know, he could play Scotland or London, but not like here.
I got
the
you.
Kind of dates you could do here, a whole tour.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, after that, went into the bed and breakfast business. And
yeah, okay. And that was up in New England, right?
In New England, yeah. We owned one in Massachusetts and Cape Cod.
Okay.
And Vermont. And then that got to be too much work and moved down and got into real estate. Mm-hmm. And now we're retired living in outside of Atlanta.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if you were back in Florida or where you ended up. Okay. And
nope. Here in Atlanta, my main goal before it gets too late is to, you know, the wife's a lot younger than me, so I'm trying to convince her to retire somewhere in Portugal or Spain. We really like Mexico. So just mm-hmm. things are getting too political here in the States.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So how would you, we'll wrap this up here in just a bit, Bobby, because I know we've been going quite a while and I appreciate that.
My battery's dying.
You're what?
That's all. Battery is dying, but that's okay. We got 11%. We're good, Mike.
Okay. So buses versus aircraft. How would you describe your experiences?
Well, you know, there's the obvious. It's the aircraft, you spend a lot less time than you do in a bus. So consequently, you know, I found that in the bus, at least you have more control of the band. You know, they can't go anywhere. However, since the rides are so long, they can get in a whole lot of trouble, even though they can't go anywhere.
Hmm.
So, you know, after 10 hours in a bus and drinking and doing whatever else they did back there in the Club Oreo,
mm-hmm.
you know, they'd just be trashed by the time they got to the hotel. Whereas when we had an airplane, they could go back to the hotel, chill, and then wake up the next day and we'd fly to the venue.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you're back to the same quandary when they're back at the hotel. They're not going to be chilling. They're just going out and getting fucked up. And that's where, you know, the double-sided sword is. In the hotel, they can go out and get in trouble. Whereas I've got them in the bus. They're all mine there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so I assume you had, like, similar. So it sounds like you've had similar experiences on both transportation devices as far as episodes, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the bus, you've got weather. You can't go over. You have to go in it and through it. So there was times where, not with Jimmy, but, you know, we were stuck in a snowstorm. We couldn't go anywhere. So,
right.
You know, stuff like that would happen. Airplanes, you know, we got to every gig with you, but we did have our episodes, you know, the time the landing gear wouldn't go up. And we had to fly lower. That was with you, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I wondered. I remember, in fact, it was in the F-90, and I don't think this is the same episode, but this kind of happens sometimes, and this is back, early flight navigation equipment, but we were in Spokane, and you guys, I know Jimmy was pretty well hungover, but I think most everyone was, and it was a day trip to get you over to the next gig for your sound check, and we ended up landing at the wrong fucking airport.
Oh, great. I don't remember that one.
Yeah, we landed at the wrong airport, and there's a guy waving us in. I'm going, this is not the right FBO, Bill. Or I forget the pilot. It was the F-90 captain. I go, this is not the right FBO. And we look down at our sectionals, and we're going, fuck. It's like the airport is 5 miles over. And so we said, I'm sorry, man, we just have to hop over one more airport. We'll just keep the gear down, but we got to go over to.
That may have been the story there, but, you know, between a bus and an airplane, considering both pros and cons, I always would put airplane first. It didn't beat you up as much. You know, being in a bus for 10 hours, it's brutal. It really beats you up a lot. So airplanes, once we, you know, went to airplanes, we never looked back. And our airplanes always got bigger and better each year as Jimmy made more and more money. So that was always nice.
Yeah.
I remember, funny story, I can't remember which one, but, you know, in the beginning, we were still playing a lot of just college towns. So, you know, we'd go into small FBOs where they've never seen an airplane like ours before, you know,
right.
Like a little Piper or something. So it's like, holy shit, look at these. Who the fuck is this, the president or something? So I remember one. I'm pretty sure it was the weather wasn't that great to us and it was bumpy. So everyone was really ready to get off the airplane and get into our nice limousines and be taken to our hotel. And it was like some little podunk college town where we don't have limousines here, Mr. Levy. You know, it's like, oh, God, okay, well, send something that's nice to pick us up. So we landed, and everyone's just, let's get me off this plane, Bobby. Jimmy was in piss-ass mode. And the cars pull up, and they go, okay, they're black Cadillacs. That looks okay. That's okay. And van pulled up too. And apparently the only thing they could find in that little town was like a funeral home car. And this guy gets out of the car, and I swear to God, Mike, he looked like Lurch from the Addams Family. And Jimmy turns to me and goes, you got to be fucking kidding me, right? We're in this little town. This is the best they could find. So these guys have never driven any living people around. So I don't think, you know, I think they got us lost going into town or going to the hotel or something. So it's like just every minute we go in the car longer, Jimmy's just getting more and more pissed off. It's like just one of those things. I go, you know, what do you want me to do? Okay, you want in a limousine? Here's your limousine. Next time we'll get a rental car, okay? But just to see the look on his face when we got in, because one of them was a hearse, I think, and they put all the luggage in the back. Oh my God.
That's great. Great story. That's so fucking funny.
I think I'm going to leave you with that story, Michael.
That is really funny. I remember going into one of those. Yeah, you're right. We went into a lot of those college towns in the F-27 because we could do it with that size of an aircraft. It was capable of flying in
right.
and out. And quite a few times because we were wearing Jimmy Buffett T-shirts mostly. You know, we did not have a fucking suit on. And we would pull up, and there'd be Learjets around us with all these suits. You know, all these pilots with suits and epaulets and all that shit.
Uh-huh.
And they'd come over. And I don't know if you remember, Bill Merrick looked like the singer Mac Davis at the time. And a couple people thought it was Mac Davis flying his own airplane. But a lot of these suits we would get off the plane. These suits, they you know, after your limo left or whatever vans or whatever you guys were in that day, the pilots of these Learjets would come over with these suits going, who the fuck are you guys? Can we fly for you?
Oh, I know. We'd pull into these little airports and then, you know, this big old jet pull in next to the Lears, and then three limos would pull up to the airplane, and then a band would back in, you know, it's like 5 minutes later, we'd be out of there and go, what the hell was that? Oh, that was good stuff. Good time.
Yeah, it was. Two more good time things, and I'll let you go.
Okay.
One is, what we would call in the industry a quick out. And sometimes these quick outs would happen, and this is where the road manager like you must have been going fucking nuts. But if the quick out was something that we knew we were going to do, it was pretty easy. But if the weather came up and you would call me at the hotel or something, I go, Bobby, we got to leave tonight because tomorrow it's going to be snowing like a motherfucker and we'll never get out of here. And you would be stuck going, oh, I just couldn't imagine the shit you were going through. I got to go and try to find hotels at 2 in the morning right now.
That's a quick out, yeah. That was always fun.
Yeah.
No internet either. Telephone.
Mm-mm.
And calling cards, buddy.
But how
and,
would
you know, the quick out.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, the quick outs in general, how would you describe? I mean, a lot of those were planned, of course.
Right, the quick outs were mostly planned. I mean, usually the weather wasn't an issue. We got lucky.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have to make hotel reservation. I mean, that was a bitch, you know. It's not like we just needed six rooms or something. Well, the crew was on their own, so it was just us 12, but that's not easy, it's, you know, that night when you need rooms for a 3 a.m. arrival or something.
Right.
That's when you just get on the phone and do it. The quick outs that I thought you were referring to was at the venue when, you know, we'd have to right after
yeah,
the show.
Yeah, okay, that's another way to look at quick outs. See, there's a different terminology for, quick out. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Our quick outs were, you know, you get off the stage and you go right into the limousine. So, so we would have to make sure that nothing was left behind, no wives or musicians, you know, fingers having to stop at the bathroom to take a pee. No, you've got to, or looking for the whiskey bottle. You've got a window, a very small window. You have to get out of there before the traffic starts leaving. So,
And it was usually when the crowd was still in the venue chanting for the third encore, and they ain't going to get it.
Right, right. And usually the house lights didn't go up yet, so that gave you that chance. But, you know, if you didn't do it right away, you'd be fucked. Then you'd be sitting in traffic, and everyone in the limousines, including the boss, would be yelling at you.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the airplane's waiting for us to take off at the airport.
Yeah. Now, every tour I remember we had, there was a saying, you know, the one that stands out for me was the Eat Shit and Die tour.
Uh-huh. Okay.
that was a good one. And the other one, if you recall, was the Where's Jimmy t-shirts we had made up. Because everywhere you go, you tell them what you're doing, and they go, oh, that's great what you do. Where's Jimmy?
Well, where's Jimmy? Or Where's Irving?
Irving,
that was a t-shirt,
yeah.
Too. Well, Where's Jimmy? It's with the Club Oriole, too, you know, all these girls. Well, where's Jimmy?
Exactly.
Or whenever you went to dinner. Oh, you worked for Jimmy Buffett? Well, where's Jimmy? he'll be here shortly.
I forget what was the back of the t-shirt. The front said, where's Jimmy? And I don't know, did the back say, who the fuck cares? Or something like that? Or
God, I don't remember that one.
If those shirts still exist or not.
We'll have to Google that one.
And on a final note, I remember talk about what you probably experienced so much is people trying to get backstage, right?
And I still
this
get
is
that.
Definitely for your book, is all the shenanigans they try to pull to get backstage. And I'll tell you a quick story, and then I'd love to hear one or two of yours. I'm at the I drove down from the mountain, Big Bear. You remember I lived in Big Bear at the time in Southern California before moving to Durango.
Oh, almost crashed our airplane.
Yeah,
into
that's
this Big Bear Lake.
we worked on that a little bit to get it down, right?
And I almost crashed landing at LAX. I don't know how I could do that on a 10,000 foot runway, but I couldn't seem to put it down. I was like cruising over the. Yeah. And you went. You know, you can land any time now, Bob. My poor knees were shaking so much I couldn't go the last 10 feet.
Yeah, sometimes too much runway's a bitch.
But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so I remember coming down for a show. I said, yeah, I'm going to come down for a show. I knew it was one of those deals that I had already finished flying you, but I was close by to a venue. Universal City is what it was.
Uh-huh.
And I basically did not go backstage early because I got to the gig late, and so I worked my way over to the kind of the backstage area to where you're allowed to come in, right? You know, as far as it was Hobbit that was running the I guess you call it the gateway, and so I'm sitting there talking to a chick. And she's telling me this story about, oh yeah, I told her what I did, and then I go, well, what do you do? You're waiting to go backstage. What was it you do for the band? She goes, oh, I do the album cover, post, facial artwork to make Jimmy look younger.
Okay.
And I said, okay, and so.
Okay.
I get up to the line, and Hobbit's look. He yells at me. He's going, Lofton, what the fuck are you doing down there? Get up here. And I go, okay, do you know her? And Hobbit goes, who the fuck are you? She could
That's
not answer. Hobbit. She was not going to go with the facial thing because she knew that wasn't going to work.
Not with Hobbit.
No. So just curious, do you have a couple quick stories to finish up with little backstage people trying to get in?
Oh, Lord. Well, you know,
see, I just gave you a whole book right there.
I mean, after a while, you just heard them all, and you just leery about everything. So that's a tough one. That is a tough one.
You're going to have 20 of them when we get off the phone, I know. But
exactly. You know, everybody's perception of what went on backstage and what really went on backstage is two totally different things. You know, they think there's groupies running around naked,
right,
wild orgies and stuff. And, you know, the reality of it, at least when we used to, you know, near the end when we were grown-ups, it was like, you know, everyone sitting backstage, most boring thing in the world, where there's beautiful women in another dressing room. Nobody wants to have anything to do with any of them. So... Mm-hmm. You know, in the early days, Jimmy never was really into having these wild parties backstage. It would usually be in the hotels after the show.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember any crazy backstage stories with them. Maybe I'm just trying to blank them out.
Well,
you know,
I'm thinking what somebody would try to, you know, just as crazy backstage people trying to get way backstage with their story, you know, just silly. Oh, I got to see him because my sister-in-law's dog was his brother's best friend, I think, you know, kind of something stupid.
The crazy thing about it is, you know, you would, in the beginning, I would like, oh, yeah, right. So, and then I'd go back and tell Jimmy, you know, the craziest thing that just happened. I met this lady that says you babysitted their sister-in-law's dog when you lived in Pascagoula. And he goes, oh, yeah, tell her to come back. And I go, really? So you really would never know what was true and what wasn't true. So most of the time, you know, I would see if they were legitimate. But, you know, you heard just all kinds of crazy shit because Jimmy did a lot of, you know, not small venues when he was getting to be big. So
yeah,
most of the time, you know, he knew a lot of Bubbas and Bubettes and stuff. So back then, you know, everything was Wild West in the backstage. and you know, when he got to be a little more at depth of being a rock star, you know, well, this is crazy shit. I like my privacy at backstage. So mm-hmm. we didn't have that many crazy stuff going on. But yeah, in the beginning, it was insane. You thought you heard of everything. And then when Hobbit came, you know, Hobbit took care of all that crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But we didn't, we got walkie-talkies. We thought it was God. We didn't have to run back and forth between the dressing room uh-huh. and the backstage and the box office.
Yeah.
That was how that went down. Like, when you hang up, I'll probably remember all these crazy
stories. Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, bro. It's good to hear your voice again.
Same here, buddy. So, are you far along with writing?
You know, everybody asked me, you know, I don't know if you noticed, I've been jamming lately. I've been playing drums now. So,
yep.
I play about two or three times. I'm a host a drummer for an open mic, and I do, I'm a Grateful Dead cover band, and just
cool.
a fill in every once in a while for, you know, these country club bar kind of places. And I played in a country trio the other night, which was pretty cool, you know, just kind of mixing it up a little bit. But, yeah, hanging out here in your old stomping grounds a little bit further north, not too much further north, New Hampshire.
Okay.
I never thought I would move here, but my daughter 5 years ago told me she was having twin boy and girls, so I ended up moving out here. And I still communicate with Sun. You remember Sunshine, my ex-wife?
Yeah, I do. Now, where in New Hampshire do you live?
I live now just in, near Manchester. I first moved to Nashua, which is just over the border. I didn't know. I had no expectations of moving to New England, for God's sakes. But my daughter lives in Littleton, Mass.
Uh-huh.
And so it's only, but I couldn't. Speaking of politics, I'm more of a independent libertarian, I guess you call me, and I just rebel. Some people call me a conspiracy theorist, but when it turns into truth, what do you call me then? But
smart. But so we used to live in New Hampshire, down by Lake Sunapee in Newberry.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah.
That's where one of our bed and breakfasts were. So I liked it there. It's just, you know, the winters are long, the summers are too short.
Yeah. Well, you know, with me coming from Big Bear and then Durango, I was used to the winters.
That's true, and they're not so as severe as Colorado.
They really aren't so bad. I mean, it can get a little wet and sticky, as you know, sometimes in the summer. But yeah, but I was living in the desert for a while. Like, I moved out here, and it was like, I don't know, 93 and sweaty. But people going, how can you handle, you know, this heat? And I go, I just came from the desert. It was 112. And they said, no,
God.
But that's a dry heat. And I go, have you been in a convection oven?
Yeah, it's not dry. You're wet, sweaty.
Yeah. You're...
Whoever brought up that dry, I think it was the Chamber of Commerce. Oh, it's a dry heat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, bullshit.
You come visit us. We're dry heat.
It's a dry heat. It's only 112, but it's dry.
Yeah, so to answer your question, now that I still don't have dementia quite yet, so I'm glad I'm remembering your original question here. But the book, it's been 20 years in the making, and I just been making notes and fucking notes and notes, and now I've compiled chapters. I actually have, to the point now where I'm just going back over a lot of chapters that have been written and just filling in with the notes, you know, adding a paragraph here and there that kind of helps supplement it. And I got plenty of, I think one things that are lacking in some of these books, and you might want to consider, now you said that you had not taken too many photographs, but do you have some archive images?
I do. You know, I have a whole trunk of pictures I have to go through. I do have some of my own. I know a lot of them Tom Corcoran was taking back then, but I do have. Remember my buddy Johnny D?
I remember that name, yeah.
He passed recently, but he has a box of all the old stuff he saved. So I'm trying to get a lot of that. You know, like I have a pictures of old contracts of Jimmy's.
Yeah.
The ride.
Yeah.
Stuff, interesting shit like that that nobody ever sees.
Absolutely. And that's the stuff that you don't see a lot in these even these so-called, what were we talking about, sensationalism, the actual, some of these books that just talk about the artists and stuff, there's still not enough images
right.
of it. It's all a lot of copy.
Yeah. Right.
And I think people are interested in seeing more visuals.
Exactly.
So don't be afraid to show them up. I'm going to start pulling out more of them and... And it's not like you're trying to fill space because you've got enough copysmith words to fill in the blanks. But here again, if you spread out some images throughout the book, I think it's going to help the visualization.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, sometimes words, pictures tell a thousand, you know, picture tells a thousand, you know, thousand
yeah.
words. So,
yeah.
After a while, you start sounding repetitious with words. So they would love to see some of these pictures that no one ever takes.
Yeah.
I just wish we took more pictures back then.
Oh, God, yeah.
Although, thank God we didn't.
Yeah.
Also, so.
Yeah.
It's a good, bad thing.
Yeah, yeah. All right, brother. Thank you so much for your time, man.
Good. Yeah, stay in touch.
Absolutely. We'll do a little Facebook touch every once in a while here.
Okay, buddy. Take care. Good talking to you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.